We all have heirlooms, things we're holding on to because of their family connections. It could be a book or a wedding dress, maybe an old home movie. How to keep those objects accessible and in good condition for the next generation is the topic on Focus today. I'm Jim Meadows. This Saturday, the U of I's Spurlock Museum holds its biannual preservation emporium to help folks preserve their heirlooms. We'll do our own version right now on Focus with Spurlock Collections Manager Chris D.C. Quinn, preservationist Jennifer Hain Tepper from the U of I Library, and WYLL's own Director of New Media, Jack Brighton. We welcome your calls. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. What do you have that's been in your family a long time, or that you want to be in the family a long time? Today we'll be talking about ways to preserve family heirlooms, whether it's your grandmother's quilt or the unpublished novel you have saved on floppy disks. It's a preview to an event held every 2 years by the University of Illinois Preservation Working Group. Heirlooms, Artifacts, and Family Treasures, a preservation emporium, is set for this Saturday afternoon from 1 until 4 at the Spurlock Museum on the U of I Urbana campus. There'll be plenty of preservation experts on hand to answer your questions. We've got three of them right here in the studio, braving the weather. I want to say welcome to Krista D.C. Quinn. She is the collections manager at Spurlock Museum.
Good morning.
And Jennifer Hain Tepper is head of preservation and conservation for the University of Illinois Libraries.
Good morning.
And Jack Brighton is WILL's own director of new media and a former producer for Focus.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
Welcome back to the show, all of you. And if you have a question about preserving something important to you, our guests don't cover all categories, but they cover an awful lot of them. And they can also tell you about some of the other guests and experts who will be at the event this Saturday. So give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, besides phone or email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And you can reach us at Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Krista, I want to focus first on the event itself that's going on in Spurlock. You do this every 2 years. How long has this been going on?
We started doing this event in 2007.
In 2007, I'm trying to see, 7, 9, 11, so 3 or 4 of these things?
Yeah, definitely.
What spurred getting this started in the first place?
Well, the Preservation Working Group is all about preserving both the campus assets, but we also wanted to reach out to the community and be able to provide information to them, because we thought if campus is interested, well, we thought the general public would be as well.
And what sort of response have you had at these events?
We've had quite really, really great response. We've had as many as 130 people at one of our events, and all sorts of types of things coming in.
And this really brings in the larger question. I can throw this out at all three of you. What's the importance of preserving things from the past? You know, if you're an institution, if you're a museum, if you're a radio station, for that matter, you have an interest in keeping hold of things. But why is this become important on the family level for things which may not be of interest to history, for instance?
Well, I think that, especially in today's world, we're so based on technology and everything has become fleeting and ephemeral, and holding on to the things that make our families unique, that tell us about, you know, how our family has come forward and what's brought us here to where we are today, are really important to hold on to, because it's a viscerality almost that you can connect with these physical things, and that the definition of physical, of course, is changing, because I know, you know, Jack deals a lot with the digital realm, and more of today's heirlooms, of course, are now actually digital heirlooms, but nonetheless they still certainly warrant preservation. But I know, because I'm a book and paper person, that I just feel a certain visceral reaction, I don't know what else to say, when I handle something that is 200 years old that I know my ancestors held and that they've written in. And
or you have in my husband's family, they have a family christening gown that goes back at least about 60 to 70 years, that every single grandchild has worn in the family. And so that piece and that has been preserved, as well as the bassinet that, you know, that the baby slept in. So that's been passed on. So it's really a great tradition.
Yeah, these physical items really tell the stories of our families and our lives and our history in a way that, you know, words can, but the physical objects are critical to the telling of that story. So a lot of people, I think visceral is a great word, Jennifer, we feel attached. They're part of us. They're part of our story and our lives. So, I mean, yeah, it's subjective, the value of many of these things, but intensely valuable to many of us.
So how did the event this Saturday work? I understand there's going to be a lot of experts in different fields of preservation.
Yes, we'll have a variety of experts. Basically, we bring people in from all over the community to try to cover almost every type of family heirloom we can think of. And we'll all have individual tables set up with signs on them so you can tell who to go to. And people can just bring their artifacts, or they can bring pictures of them if they don't want to physically bring them with them. You know, find the table that covers that particular area, and then talk to the preservation expert about making sure that you can do your best to make sure that that object is around for the next 200 years.
What sort of objects have people brought in? Have you seen anything unexpected come in?
Oh, I saw we ended up having a wagon cover from the Civil War that actually had it had bullet holes in it and everything else. And we've had a flag. I've had a sword come in. So there's been some interesting family things that have come in.
And what sort of fields of specialty are, you know, what sort of folks are going to be there this Saturday?
We'll have a nice variety of people. This is Jennifer. I'll be doing photographs. We'll have a conservator there doing flat paper and another conservator covering books. Krista will be doing predominantly textiles and then kind of objects. She gets the catch-all.
I get the weird stuff. They're like, and send that to Krista.
A colleague of ours will be looking at kind of general collections care and just how to clean things, how to store them, etc. That kind of encompasses all collections. Jack will be there for digital material. We'll have people doing fine arts like paintings and sculpture. Someone there for musical instruments. Someone there covering digital media and digital preservation. And then folks covering audiovisual materials. So,
okay, audiovisual materials might be things like
moving image and sound. So motion picture film is one that a lot of people have that they're not sure what to do with, as well as obviously VHS tapes, sound recordings, open reel audio,
okay,
that sort of stuff.
Yeah, actually, my own show and tell, if I were to bring it in, would have been in that category.
Mm-hmm, I bet.
And this really brings in some of the challenges facing here. Let me do my show and tell here.
Okay.
And that is, I worked a while back with some recordings I had of my parents. They were, one-off homemade recordings. Three of them were made in a little coin-operated recording booth at some penny arcade somewhere, either in Boston or New Orleans, I'm not quite sure, over 60 years ago. And these were tiny little 78 RPM records made of very cheap material, which I found was an issue when I was playing them back to try to dub them onto CD in this case, because I found that they were very cheap plastic laminating over cardboard. And the plastic had dried and started to show cracks. It took a few passes to get everything to track. The fourth record was from my mother's, I think, high school or college German language class, in which she had to read something in German and get a critique. This is something which is of zero value of anybody else but me and my sister, because they're the only recordings we have of our parents. And I can imagine those might be the sort of things that people might bring this Saturday, figuring out what do you do with these sort of things. They're barely playable on a 78 RPM phonograph if you can get that equipment. And maybe part of the challenge there for, and maybe this is something, Jack, that you can talk about, is finding the equipment to play back or show these various media so you can transfer them to something else.
Yeah, I mean, you have several problems there. You've got the physical nature of the recording that is falling apart in the case of something that's made of cardboard and plastic. You have the equipment to play it back, which is definitely a challenge. You know, and then you just have the problem of so much of this stuff. In terms of audio and video material, moving images and sound, we've got recordings that go back, well, film over 100 years. And film is actually very stable compared to many other kinds of recordings. And then you have magnetic media that, or physical media like discs and wax cylinders that were the early sound recording methods. And all those things are incredibly fragile and hard to play back and hard to find the equipment. And you also need expertise in many cases to, you know, not just have the equipment, but know how to use it properly and adjust it correctly as you ran into, you know, a problem yourself. So those are tremendous challenges. And the sheer volume of this material is such that unless we really pay attention to, you know, the value of it and prioritize its transformation to forms that can last longer than the original format, then we're going to lose a lot of our history. And that's really the challenge we're all facing. And in large institutions, individual, you know, humans in dealing with their collections, we all have that same challenge, is the ephemeral nature of these recordings.
This is Focus. We are talking about ways to preserve your family heirlooms. There's an event coming up this Saturday at Spurlock Museum at the U of I campus. We have some of the experts who will be at that event with us today. They can answer your questions. Jack Brighton, Director of New Media at WILL, Krista D.C. Quinn of Spurlock Museum, and Jennifer Hain Tepper of the U of I Libraries. Give them a call. The phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. You'll find us on Twitter, our Facebook, at Focus580. I know that in the case of phonograph records, I'm finding that one of the things you can find relatively easily are phonographs that will dub onto something else.
Right.
And if you have something of that media that you want to preserve that way, it'll probably have to be an LP or a 45, maybe if you get the right stylus, a 78 RPM record. But of course, that leaves, and maybe cassette tapes as well on these sort of units.
Yeah. Well, here's part of the challenge. When you dub from these original formats to digital, people think, well, I'll make a CD of this recording or a DVD of this film. The problem with that is CDs and DVDs are also very fragile, and they're formats that are going to become obsolete. And they're also not the highest quality recording that you can possibly get. So the best practice is to, if you're going to digitize something that is, you know, starts out as either a disc or, you know, whatever the original format is, film, make it a digital file in the highest quality you can possibly afford. And then you have another problem, because now you have a digital file
right.
that you're going to have to care for over time. And, you know, hard drives go bad, so you make copies and you have to keep track of all these files because now you have a large number of files. So managing in the digital media realm is more difficult than just having tapes on a shelf.
This is a challenge. Also, we don't know what the next format is going
right.
to be for our digital format. If you were putting something down in a personal computer, say 20 years ago, could you be sure that you can get it back out today?
The problem in the digital media realm is there are no clear standards, or I would say there are standards, but they are patented and owned by either companies or consortia of companies that own those formats. There are some open formats, but they're relatively underutilized by many people. And over time, we're going to see different formats, and you're absolutely right. 20 years ago, you might have recorded something into a format that we cannot play right
now. Have you run up against this problem yourself?
Not so much 20 years ago, but when we were originally putting audio and video on the web, for example, which is something I've been doing since, you know, the late 90s, we were using a format called Real Audio and Real Video, and that format is no longer used, quite frankly. It's also lesser quality. So if all we had were the Real Video and Real Audio files, then we would have lost a lot of the value of the original material. Fortunately, we didn't do that. We saved all the original source files. So now when the next format comes along, we can you know, transfer those files to the new format.
It's a little ghostly almost because we're talking about images and sounds, trying to keep those while we may be changing the thing that holds them. When we're talking about, say, what Jennifer, what you'll be talking about, I think, is photographs.
Mm-hmm.
There is an important image there, but you are talking about a physical object, and you have to figure out how to preserve that photograph and what not to do with it.
Correct.
And what do people do when they have photographs, or if they have slides,
right,
and things like that? How do you keep these things preserved over a period of time, and what can you do with them to put them in the shape where you can look at them?
Right. Well, a lot of people actually come and ask whether or not digitization is the appropriate things to do for their historic photographs, because, of course, everybody, you know, thinks about digitizing things now as a mode of preservation. And in the case of the materials that Jack is talking about, transferring digitally is necessary because the original is going to fail, like the discs that you were talking about. With photographs in most cases, and honestly with the lion's share of stuff that Krista and I work with, the physical stuff, that object is inevitably actually far more stable than any digital file you could produce. So our job is to try to preserve the original. With photographs, and honestly with just about any organic material, which is the lion's share of what people have, the mantra is cool, dark, and dry. Storage is your number one key, and just make sure that you keep the materials in an appropriate environment that's going to slow down deterioration.
Is the family photo album that sort of environment, or would you recommend something else?
Absolutely. No, cool, dark, and dry.
Just don't leave it out in the sun.
Don't leave it in the sun.
Don't leave it out on the coffee table with the picture window open during the summer.
Exactly, exactly. If you've got an interior closet, that often is the place that we're going to recommend. You want to keep them out of the attic, keep them out of the basement, which unfortunately a lot of us end up putting lesser used objects that we have into storage areas in the basement and the attic. But attics get very hot and dry. Basements tend to be very damp. Both of those are not ideal for long-term storage. So interior closets in the main body of the house is usually what we recommend. We'll have lots of examples and freebies of good storage enclosures, which for books, photographs, albums,
textiles
is really critical because you also want to make sure that you're physically protecting it. And so a good quality box is a big step as well.
How long can you keep things like color slides? How do they preserve?
Well, part of it depends on the format. And unfortunately, I wish there was just one answer I could give people, but there's so much of this depends. With slides, the big thing is, was it a chrome-based color process or not?
How would you know?
Most of them will be labeled on the frame that holds the slide. So Kodachrome is certainly the brand that most people are familiar with. There's also Ilfachrome and Cibachrome. No, Cibachrome's a print. There's another slide format. It's Ilfachrome and Kodachrome are the two big ones. But they those are actually remarkably stable color processes by comparison. True, just chromogenic slides, which are not those, tend to fade more. But the number one thing with any color process, be it a slide or be it a print, is how much light has it seen. Dark storage is really critical. The reason that a lot of slides still look good is because you show them maybe once a year when your family comes by, and then they sit in a slide carousel in the dark for the rest of the year. A lot of us will put color photographs up on the wall, and those are the ones that we see fade.
I'm wondering, at a time when it's hard to find a chemical film camera, can you find a slide projector?
They are still available on eBay. I bought one not too long ago. But they are certainly a dying technology.
So maybe in this case, digitization maybe becomes a convenience in order to be able to see the things.
Yes. And what you're getting at is the difference between preservation and access. Mm-hmm. And what digitization of slides, of photographs, of a lot of AV materials, because motion picture film is a good example. Those are actually all fairly stable objects on their own, but they're really hard in some cases to access the information there. But digitization is a great way to share them and to be able to look at them and then put the original someplace safe, cool, dark, and dry so that you always have those to go back to in case you have failure of your digital files.
Is it possible across, and I'm working off a question that's left by a caller, is it possible that people have artifacts which may actually be of interest to some sort of museum or archive? And if they did, how would they find out about that?
Okay, well, we have inquiries all the time, so quite often people will contact our registration department and they may be willing to give an artifact or they want to know, they want to identify an artifact. Jennifer was talking about access. We have 3D objects. Some of them are very large, difficult to get at, but we have photos of them. They're posted on the web so that everyone can have access to them, scholars, the public, that kind of thing. So usually, at least I think with the library as well, if people are interested in giving, they contact the collections departments, and then they can, you know, go through a process that way. As far as Saturday's event, if you want to learn about your different types of potential artifacts or heirlooms, we're there to help you out.
Okay, so if you brought it, I'm just trying to imagine, what might somebody have in their attic? A letter from a president, a stuffed passenger pigeon, something like that.
Arrowheads, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. African masks. You'd be surprised. We have a lot of artifacts that have come into our museum that were in people's living rooms.
Well, if you have a question about that, and if you think maybe you have something like that, go ahead and give us a call. I'm going to give out the number after the break. I also want to talk with you, Krista, about all those different sorts of physical objects, the sort of things that museums have to worry about, and, you know, how do you worry about it when it's in your attic and you want to keep it? We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more about preserving heirlooms here on Focus on WYLL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We are discussing family heirlooms, anything from old paper to artwork to clothing to digital media, how to keep it in good condition for your next generation. My guests are experts in their particular fields of preservation. Krista D.C. Quinn of Spurlock Museum is familiar with materials like, well, stone, ceramic, plaster, metals, plant material, textiles, and clothing. Jennifer Hain-Tepper of the U of I Libraries knows about preserving photographs. Jack Brighton, our own director of new media here at WYLL, knows about digital media, and they can answer your questions about those and maybe some related items if you want to get a little bit in the left field. Go ahead and give us a call. Do you have a treasured family antique or heirloom or just odd thing that you want to keep around? Go ahead and make us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Krista, I'm wondering, you have to deal with all sorts of objects at Spurlock Museum of all sorts of ages.
It keeps it interesting.
And this is stuff, a lot of it, you know, frankly, was not meant to last.
Exactly. I mean, our oldest artifact is 500,000 years old. And that's a stone tool. It's actually in really great shape. And then we have modern pieces. A lot of people think that plastics are forever. They're not. Jennifer's laughing because it's true. I have plastics that are only like 20 to 30 years old that are completely coming apart.
Well, when I think of that little coin-operated recording booth phonograph record, that's one example I think of. But any plastic job, a toy from a Cracker Jack box, would mm-hmm. that hold up after 60 years?
It depends on how it was stored. I mean, most likely it's not going to hold up as well because plastics tend to be pretty unstable. But it also depends on was it stored in an attic? Was it put in the sun? Was it played with? You know, like all of these use items.
Let's go ahead and take a call. This is on line 4. Ray from Effingham, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. My question was, I have some Currier and Ives prints. So they're from the 1860s, 1870s. And, of course, with the wood backing, they're stained, and I've taken that backing off and put acid-free, but they still were discolored and stained. And years, like 20 years ago, there used to be a place in Milwaukee where they could actually soak and clean watercolors. I don't know if there's any place in the area that still exists where they can be restored?
Yes. What you're looking for is a paper conservator, and they can do lots of advanced processes to be able to reduce staining on fine arts and paper objects. And there are a lot of good fine arts conservators out there. There are some up in Chicago. There's a company called Graphics up in Chicago. Up in Milwaukee is the Northern States Conservation Center. They are still there. They may have changed their name since 20 years ago, but it's probably still the same firm, or at least some of the same people. And they're really great. The best way to find a conservator is actually to go to the website for the American Institute for Conservation. Their web address is www.conservation-us.org. And off of that website, there's actually a link to find your find a local conservator, and it'll walk you through, you know, what sort of object do you have, what sort of treatment or consultation are you looking for, and what area or region are you in, and then it will show you all the different conservation services in your area.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
Thank you very much for calling. And that website again is conservation-us.org.
Correct.
To find out more about finding a conservator. The Currier and Ives prints, the originals, were they were prints that were then hand colored, or were they color lithographs? What were they exactly?
I believe, I'm not an expert on Currier and Ives, so the last caller will have to forgive me. I believe they are typically chromolithographs, so they're actually printed color. So they're actually very stable. The good thing about prints that are printed in color as opposed to hand color is you have a lot more flexibility in what sort of treatments you can do. So if the caller who called was interested in a process that would probably involve washing and possibly even a mild bleach to try to reduce the staining from the wood backing that those prints were mounted to, if those prints are hand colored, then the ability for you to do fairly aggressive washing diminishes. So you have less ability to remove the stains because you would also wash away the colors, because a lot of the hand coloring is done with watercolors.
And that website again, conservation-us.org, we're adding it to our website. You'll find a link at will.illinois.edu/focus. Let's take another caller on line one. Lori from Champaign, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Okay. I have quite a few county fair ribbons from the Champaign County Fair. It dates back to 1899, and quite a few from the Illinois State Fair starting in the early 1900s. I was just wondering, is there a way to preserve these, or can I put them under glass and display them?
How are they looking right now, Lori?
They're in really great shape. There's a little fraying on the ends, but other than that, you can read perfectly on the front of the ribbons.
Fair ribbons, Krista. I didn't even know what they're made out of.
Well, it depends on the time period. So it could be sometimes they were made of silk, sometimes they were made of, you know, like a nylon, you know, like a, you know, a polyester. It depends. Usually they weren't very expensive materials because they gave out quite a few of them, and county fairs don't really have a lot of money, so they weren't producing it on the best quality material. But right now our color, it sounds like they're in really great shape, so that's good. So let's keep them that way. If you want to put some on display, then what you want to do is you want to make sure you can maybe do a shadow box type of arrangement, make sure the glass does not touch the ribbons themselves. And you're going to want to realize that if you're going to hang them up on display, that any kind of light may start fading them. So you may want to take some of them and put them back in the storage, the type of storage that Jennifer talked about, cool, dark, and dry. And when you hang them up, you want to not have them facing a window, so, you know, away from a window, maybe in a guest room that's not used that often, so it's dark in there, but you can still see it every once in a while. And not underneath any type of air return vents, because quite often you'll find that any type of cool air return, there's a lot of, you know, there's different pollutants that move around your house, and you don't want dust and that kind of thing to lodge in there. And if you're near an air return, that tends to actually get into your framed works.
Okay. That's been helpful. Yes, I'd like to display them because they're very pretty colors.
Well, you want to keep those colors pretty, so make sure also that if you have fluorescent light in the room, that you may want to, of course, get filtered glass. And there's all sorts of framers you can ask them about that, about UV protection and anti-glare and that kind of thing.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Lori. Let me ask you a little bit more about just the idea of a shadow box. What are we talking about here?
Well, usually you want to have something that, you know, when we were talking about the Currier and Ives prints, wood is really very reactive, very volatile, and you don't want to put objects right up against it because it will actually, the acids from the wood will come through. So there's different types of archival materials that a lot of framing places will know about, proper framers will. And if I'm just suggesting a shadow box just because if you have glass touching any type of object, the temperature difference in a room can actually, you can get condensate, or you can get, you know, it actually crushes the pieces beneath them. So usually some type of archival shadow box, and then of course you want glass that's very protective.
And we're talking about things which are actually rather fragile, and if you're talking about storing them over time, a long time,
yeah,
what seems like pretty gentle treatment may not actually be.
It's a deterioration that can happen over time. The caller wanted to display them, so it's a question of access. So if we keep everything in a cold, dry, dark place, we may not be able to enjoy those pieces either. So at the museum, we actually put out on display only 5% of our collections, hold most of it in storage so that we can preserve it longer. If people want to be able to enjoy their heirlooms, which a lot of people do, they may want to have some of the pieces out. So maybe the caller only puts a few of the ribbons out, not all of them. Or when Jennifer was talking about the family album, maybe you make up a facsimile family album that's out on the countertop and save the originals back. So, I mean, there's ways in which to do that and realize that anytime you're putting something on display, you're putting it at risk. But also, it's up to you if you want to be able to enjoy these pieces. That's also part of their history as well.
Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu, to talk to Krista D.C. Quinn of Spurlock Museum, Jennifer Hain-Tepper of the U of I Libraries, and WILL Director of New Media, Jack Brighton. Our producer, Lindsay Moon, had a question again about objects, and this is race medals from marathons and triathlons she's competed in. She was wondering, what is the best way to care for these and keep these for a long time?
All right, so race medals. Medals, depending on the type, can actually, they really need dry more than anything else, because metal's fairly reactive.
What's the danger of happening to these metals? Are we usually talking something that may be plated?
It could be plated. It depends on how it's plated and that kind of thing. So metal wants to oxidize, meaning it wants to, in the case of like something that's made of iron, that's rust. So metal always wants to do that. So you want to keep it dry no matter what. So if you want to display these things and they have ribbons, maybe again, use the shadow box technique. I would say generally you want to keep them in a cool, dry, dark place. You put them in an enclosure, not in a basement for sure, not in an attic. And you want to make sure, depending on how it's plated, you may want to handle with gloves, because metal tends to, if you have the type of really acidic skin, you may end up etching that metal as well. If it's not pure gold, which a lot of these metals are not, unless you're in the Olympics, you may actually start, over time, those fingerprints will actually manifest themselves on the metal.
I'm wondering about, what I keep on thinking of when I think of medals is the high school and the trophy case for the real big trophies that the school gets, and these things stay there, and after 20 or 30 years, they're not necessarily looking as good as they used to. And that's just from being in a closed case, but with a lot of light, I guess.
It's the light. It's more or less, in this case, usually those trophy cases are they're wooden, and the oak and the different materials are actually outgassing out, and the metal reacts to that. And the metal also reacts to the atmosphere. So you're seeing that tarnishing effect. That's the oxidation.
Can you talk anything about, I don't know if this is on any of your particular expertise, but in preserving books.
That would be Jennifer.
That is, okay.
Yes, because definitely.
Definitely, Jennifer.
We got an email from Natalie Marquez, who's one of her heirlooms, I believe, is a photo that's displayed on the Facebook promo for today's program. But she writes about some old photo albums dating back to the 1800s, books on her family's own breed of chickens from the 1920s.
Nice.
Handwritten, awesome.
Handwritten recipe books from the 30s.
Yeah. Cool.
Old magazines and newspaper clippings, and these are the sort of things that, they just start to the fall apart after time. She says she's going to bring these over to the event at Spurlock Museum this Saturday, but maybe a little preview of what people should be looking at when they come across this stuff.
Sure.
And it's happened to me too. After my parents passed away, and I came across just all sorts of paper objects, mm-hmm. and bound objects, and you're wondering, what can you do with them, especially the ones you think are really special?
Right. Yeah. Book and paper materials are probably the most common thing that gets passed on from generation to generation. And the challenge with both of them is that there's a lot of variability in paper. So there's very good quality paper out there, and there's really poor quality paper out there. Both of them, again, are still organic material, so they still benefit from the cool, dark, dry storage. That's going to be our mantra for for the show. However, generally speaking, depending upon the quality of the paper, there are some different approaches that we can take to be able to stabilize stabilize it, or even to work with a conservator to chemically neutralize the acids in the paper. The main enemy of paper is acid. And, you know, Krista was talking about off-gassing acids from storage containers. The problem is that paper, in many cases, makes its own acids as it begins to age.
And this is the sort of thing you get from newspapers and old
newspaper,
pulp magazines.
Yeah, newspaper is the best example of it, because all of us know that if you leave a newspaper on your front stoop for more than 24 hours, you can see the color shift. But if you go into a bookstore and pick up an old paperback, they are, you know, yellow, and they have a very distinctive odor to them. We all know the used paperback smell. That's actually the free acids. That's the smell of the acids that the paper is producing, and they're off-gassing from the book itself.
If you have a whole volume of things, it may be beyond you in preserving, but if you have a single object of acidified paper that you just really want to keep, is there anything you can do?
There's a lot that you can do. There are steps to physically stabilize it. So one of the outcomes of high acidity in paper is embrittlement. And this is what we've seen with a lot of clippings in newspapers, is that the paper gets very fragile over time. There are different ways that you can stabilize that, either by using very stable plastics like polyester and putting them basically into a sleeve to help to physically support them. Conservators can actually take steps to physically strengthen it by applying things like wheat starch paste and very, very, very fine Japanese tissue to be able to support the paper. More important than that, you can actually, there are ways that you can chemically neutralize the acids to be able to bring the acid content of the paper down. So if you haven't hit that brittle point yet, you can stave that off for a good long time by reducing the amount of acid in the paper. And conservators can do that, but you can also do it yourself. There's actually a commercial product called Bookkeeper and Archival Mist is Archival Mist.
Archival Mist.
Yeah, Bookkeeper is the trade name for libraries when we're using it on a large scale. But for people who are, say, picking it up at Michael's or a scrapbooking store, both of them frequently carry it. It's just a spray. And what it is basically it's crushed up magnesium oxide in a inert fluid, and you shake it up and then you spray it on your paper. And there's a certain quantity that you're supposed to spray. And the magnesium oxide then actually bonds with the paper, and it absorbs all of the free acids in the paper. And if magnesium oxide is Tums and Rolaids, effectively. And it works exactly the same way, because it is exceedingly what we call alkaline. It is the opposite of acid. And so by putting all these little tiny alkaline particles on the paper, it absorbs all the free acids so they don't harm your paper.
You don't recommend trying to mix up your own batch from
Absolutely
Tums and
not. I would definitely use the Archival Mist.
Okay. I'm wondering, when we get into books, when you get into books where the bindings are going, maybe an old family Bible or anything like that, can bindings be repaired? Can you go? Can you find people who do that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Again, going to the AIC's website, theconservation-us.org, there are lots and lots of book conservators out there. That's actually what I'm trained as, is as a book conservator.
So do you sometimes work on repairing books?
That is my job.
So what sort of projects might you be faced with?
I mean, books can fall apart in so many different ways. The most common book damage that we see is typically going to be failure of what we call the hinge, which is the flexing point where the boards are attached to the spine. A lot of times they fall off. Obviously, there's what we call text block issues. I'm trying not to get into too much jargon, but where the pages of the book obviously become damaged. For books that are used a whole lot, we'll see a lot of damage on the spine, particularly up at the head, from people pulling it on and off the shelf all the time. It also depends on how the book was bound originally. So family Bibles, for instance, typically are leather bound. A lot of them are bound to look like an older style book. You don't see a lot of very modern looking Bibles. A lot of, especially the older family Bibles, are bound in leather. They have a certain style to them that is characteristic of books that were bound, you know, 200 years ago. And those particular style of book tend to fall apart differently than, say, a hardback that you picked up at Barnes & Noble last week. So it really depends on the age of the book. But leather in particular, and this is where Krista and I cross over, is we both get to specialize in leather, because books have leather and lots of ethnographic objects are in leather. Leather, unfortunately, just like paper, suffers over time from acid decay. And I think a lot of people have seen that orange powder that leather begins to form over time. And that's called red rot. And that's something that we're constantly combating against.
I'm wondering then that some people may have books where they might want to take the step of actually having it rebound.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're losing a piece of the artifact there, if mm-hmm. they can find something that's similar,
right.
Where do you go to do that?
Well, you have a couple different options. Most conservators will do a full, you know, historically sympathetic rebinding if you don't want to save the original. Although conservators, our job is to save as much of the original as possible whenever possible. So you'd be amazed at how much we can keep and then still make it usable, but keep a lot of the original components. That said, especially if you're in this community and you'd really just like to get a new cover on your book so that you can continue to use it. And family Bibles are a really good example of that, of a lot of people actually like to continue to use their family Bible. There's actually a shop here in town called the Lincoln Bindery who does beautiful work making boxes and rebinding books.
I've passed by that place many times mm-hmm. and was wondering if they were a place that did binding in bulk or did binding in individual projects like we're talking about
here.
They
do both. They do individual projects and they do short run and fine print.
Tell me about boxes for books. What are you talking about there?
Well, there are a lot of commercial possibilities for buying boxes for books. But if you have a really precious book that you want to save, you can actually have a custom-made box made for it that would be very pretty and would be something that you'd be comfortable, say, leaving out on the coffee table or someplace, because the box itself has a lot of visual appeal. Generally, the custom-made boxes are going to fit the object a little bit better. So again, if you're going to be handling it a lot or taking it in and out of the box a lot, a custom-made box is actually more appropriate than one that's, like, you know, conceivably a few inches too big in every direction, which would be more common of a commercially made box where you're stuck with mass-produced sizes. But there are a lot of different options for custom-made enclosures, ranging from reasonably inexpensive to ones that could run you as much as $150 or $200.
And we are giving out enclosures at our event.
That is true. We've gotten several major preservation vendors to donate preservation materials, much of which are different storage boxes, and that we'll be giving them away.
And usually they're pretty expensive, so it's mm-hmm. an exciting giveaway.
Well, we are talking about preserving family heirlooms today on Focus. The event at Spurlock Museum happens every 2 years, and it's happening this Saturday. It's from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., as I understand, at Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. Spurlock Museum, which is open today, I understand.
We are open, and people are at their museum today, believe it or not.
Okay. I have an email from a listener, which I think may be under your subject matter, Krista. What advice do you have for the preservation and display of war medals, some with ribbons, which I think we just mm-hmm. covered, and also coins? And we're talking here medals which may be of a higher quality than a sports trophy.
Yeah, coins you need to be pretty careful about not polishing them, not doing anything to them, unless you see a numismatic expert. So that's a fancy way of saying a coin specialist. And there are conservators that specifically work with coins. You want to make sure that when you have the enclosures for them, they have different types of envelopes that you can put them in. You want to make sure that it's not vinyl, that there's specific types of plastics that do not react with the coins. And you don't really want to handle your coins barehanded, especially if you have silver or older coins, because your skin oils will etch these coins.
What about the war medals? I don't know what
the war medals are. The same thing. I mean, usually they're combinations of ribbon and metal put together. So you, again, if you don't want to handle those barehanded.
So you would handle them with, like, maybe a cotton glove.
They're just a cotton glove, that type of thing. Okay. Yes.
Are there any people that you might take things to if you think something needs a little restoration?
Again, exactly the website that Jennifer pointed out. That's you want to get a conservator to look.
Conservation-us.org.
Exactly, and it'll take you right through. You can put in "I have war medals," and it'll take you right to conservators that work with that type of material.
Jack, we were talking earlier in the program about digital material, and I was thinking about how much of the preservation of digital material is really a transfer from one format to the other. Are there any challenges in making sure that everything transfers successfully, that all of those ones and zeros make it from say the floppy disk you started with to whatever you transfer it to?
So you're talking about from digital to another digital format?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, certainly anything that is stored as a digital file has a particular file structure or format, and oftentimes is compressed. You know, so, for example, a photo that you'd put on Facebook is compressed. It's squashed down from its original file size to a lesser quality file. And there are, you know, software does that. So when you're transferring from one file to another file format, software is changing the structure of that file. And there's certainly, you know, there's better ways to do that than others. You know, when you're talking about the highest resolution file, we've got, for example, videotapes that we had digitized to what's called 10-bit uncompressed video. This is a very, very large digital video file. And not all computers or software packages can even handle it. It's such a big file. So you want to make sure that, you know, if you're, it depends on what you start with and where you're going to. But there's definitely something to know about for the file formats and the software and the systems that are used to handle those things.
We have a couple of phone calls waiting, so let me go ahead and see if we can get to both of these before our time is out. On line two, Jan in Urbana, we were talking about videotape. I think, Jan, that was your question.
Yes, I have some VHS. When we were just making family videos of situations in the backyard, whatnot. Now I'd like to move those. Since I don't have a videotape player anymore, I need to make these onto, I guess, DVDs or CDs or something. Who can do this?
I don't know if there are people in town here that still do that work. There are services that you can send your tapes to. The thing that I would caution you is to definitely don't just take the VHS and make a DVD of it.
Even though there, you can go to a place like Best Buy and buy machines that do that.
Well, you can, but you want to actually make a digital file out of that you're going to have to maintain somewhere, save, backup, know where it is, and then you would make a DVD from that file. So think of the DVD as your access copy of the original tape. You know, you don't want to play that tape too many times because tape definitely wears out. And of course, you know, if you don't have a tape deck, you can't play it in the first place.
Right.
But if you have a digital file made of that tape, then you can keep that file and make as many DVDs as you want. Or as new technology comes along, there might be some new device that you're going to want to play that on. Now you have a way to transfer that file to the new format.
That's when you really have to call in the professionals, because I know the idea of trying to get that sort of thing done
right.
Sort of fills me with dread.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it yourself, especially a VHS, which isn't, you know, frankly, it's a pretty good, you know, stable format for maybe 20 years or so. But it's not the highest quality video in the first place. You're not going to get a better quality out of that VHS tape than what is already on the tape. So if you want to tackle that yourself, there are ways you can do it. You can buy equipment to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And in the case of a VHS, I wouldn't feel too bad about recommending, if you feel like you can, doing that. Mm-hmm. But if it comes to film and things like that, that's a whole other category of technical, you know.
How would I find somebody to make those?
Say again?
How would I find someone to make a digital...
Yeah, where do you find someone who can do this? We just have a few seconds.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know around locally, but you can certainly go online and find people.
They're the two big people that the library uses, both of which you would have to ship to,
yes,
are Scene Savers and Media Preserve.
Scene Savers and Media Preserve. And at this point, Jan, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop the questioning. We have a couple of questions waiting on the line, and perhaps our guests would be ready to take these callers if they can hold on for a few minutes.
Sure.
But
fine.
We can't do it on the air because we're out of time. But there will be time this Saturday at Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. That's from 1 to 4 p.m. for the biannual Preservation Emporium. All of my guests today will be there. Krista D.C. Quinn of Spurlock Museum, Jennifer Hayne-Tepper of the U of I Libraries, and Jack Brighton, WILL's Director of New Media, plus several other folks and a guest speaker as well. That's this Saturday at Spurlock Museum. Thanks to all of you who called or emailed questions. Apologies for anyone who didn't make it to the air. Focus was produced by Lindsay Moon today, Jason Croft, our technical director, Ryan Weber is our intern. Coming up on Focus tomorrow, my guest will be Ramoki Huma. He is president of the National College Players Association. His group is representing football players at Northwestern University who want to form a union. More about that on Thursday's show. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear Focus over the air on AM 580, online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.